The Church of God, the Eternal, presents the 30th message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, July 25th, 2026.
Well, we want to handle the next installment in this series on the life of David as told by God in the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, a series that I've entitled Survey of the Books of Samuel. We're getting very, very near the end of 1 Samuel. Last time, if you can recall, it's been a few weeks, but we completed a review of 1 Samuel chapter 29 with the Philistine kings. Remember, five Philistine kings all banded together with the armies to attack Israel. And King Achish of Gath is the one who is the friend of David and has basically rolled out the red carpet for him and his men and their families to live in his Philistine territory, gave him the city of Ziklag, and then brought David as his personal bodyguard for this huge battle against King Saul in Israel. And the other four kings of the Philistines said, we ain't having him. They were the wise ones. They understood not to trust David and his warrior band. And so we went through and looked at the history of those warriors that the books of Samuel as well, and especially in Chronicles, 1 Chronicles chapter 11 and 12, show these were mighty men. These were significant battle-tested individuals, and David had this huge cadre of them all in one group of 600 men. So the other kings wisely said, we're not having this guy. We don't trust him. Send him home, and that's what happened. So God seems to have intervened to facilitate David's exclusion from the impending battle. And now God doesn't choose to record the intents of heart in a lot of these characters, including David. But I just gave you and pieced it together based upon what we've already seen David do. Do you really think David was going to go to war with the Philistines to try to destroy the Israelites and King Saul? Well, that was totally out of character from all the decisions he'd previously made. My conclusion is he literally was planning to turn on the Philistines, that this was going to be his coup in order to make himself a part of the Philistine army, especially in the rear guard, protecting King Achish, and then in the heat of battle, literally turn and decimate the Philistines from the rear to help Israel, not to harm them. Otherwise, why would he have not taken the opportunity twice before over the previous years to kill Saul when Saul was in his hands? So none of that makes sense if you think David really had turned in favor of the Philistines. However, and what I'm going to show you in chapter 30 that we're going to cover today, every indication is this was David doing his will his way, trying to achieve something that was good, that was within the will of God, and yet not doing according to God's instruction, but making up his own plan. If that's true, then what you see of the fact that the Philistine kings all said to Achish, we're not having him, send him home. That was God's intervention and defeated David's personal plan to try to help Israel by destroying the Philistines from the rear. So David and his army are sent back home, quote unquote, home to Ziklag. All right. So today in chapter 30, we're going to see a side story because now these Philistines are all assembled and arrayed on the north end of the Jezreel Valley. Saul and his army at Mount Gilboa on the south side of that same huge valley. There's in this standoff getting ready for this big conflict. Well, now chapter 30 gives us a sideline story, a parallel story. And so we're not even going to talk about the battle because that's going to be in chapter 31. Okay. So now we're talking about a parallel event that took place probably literally while the battle was ensuing. And we'll read that story later. But David is sent back. So we begin in chapter 30, verse 1. It came to pass when David and his men were come to Ziklag on the third day. So from this mustering point where all the Philistines got together before then heading on to the battle site, it took David a full 2 days plus, if it's on the third day, when he and his army arrived back at their homes. So on the third day that the Amalekites had invaded the south, meaning the south of the provinces of the Philistines, and Ziklag, and smitten Ziklag and burned it with fire. Verse 2, and had taken the women captives that were therein, they slew not any, either great or small, but carried them away and went on their way. So what has happened is that while David and all his army were in the north with the Philistines, and all the rest of the Philistines were all now centered far to the north, which we went through and showed you where that was, where the site of this battle, unusually for the Philistines who normally attacked Israel in the south. This is the first time they moved their army all the way to the north, which means they opened up a huge opportunity for the enemies of the south, the enemies of the Philistines, as well as the Israelites, especially these Amalekites now, who lived in the desert regions far to the south of both of these nations, now takes the opportunity and makes this incursion when basically there's a vacuum of these fighting men have disappeared. Now, it's also very likely, and we don't know because God doesn't tell us anything about what time of year this was, but if it follows the normal course, armies went to war in the spring and in the early summer because they wanted good weather, not only for the sake of their fighting men, but also for the food supply, and they didn't want to be dealing, obviously, with the extremes, either of extreme heat in the summer or extreme cold in the winter. All right, so if you try to put together a possible scenario, we're probably talking about late spring or early summer when this is taking place, which would have been the time when everybody wants to go to war. It makes perfect sense. This is when the Philistines would have decided they want to get this big army together to attack the Israelites, would have been that time. It's also the time when a lot of the crops, the early crops are coming in. The Amalekites and the others in the south in the desert territories would have been wanting to go on their raiding parties. There's actually more actually to take, to derive in booty from their excursions into their enemy territory. So speculation, yes, but if it helps add somewhat to an understanding of the circumstances, hopefully that adds to and not takes away. So the Amalekite raids to the north often exploited the vulnerabilities during or after harvest season when the settlements were stocked but less defended. And now you've got this huge battle going on. The Amalekites couldn't pass up the opportunity to go raiding at this particular time. All right, continuing in verse 3. So David and his men came to the city, and behold, it was burned with fire, and their wives and their sons and their daughters were taken captive. Verse 4, then David and the people that were with him lifted up their voices and wept until they had no more power to weep. Utter devastation mentally. To have everything you love now has been taken while you've been away on this excursion, and you come back and everything you love is gone, especially in the hands of such diabolical enemies as the Amalekites. Verse 5, and David's two wives were taken captive, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail, the wife of Nabal the Carmelite, the former wife, because Nabal was dead. And take note, as we're going to verify, David did not yet have any children, which seems odd to me. He's got these wives, and yet he doesn't have any children. All right, because we're going to find when we get into the first chapters of 2 Samuel, his children, the first of his children, were actually born after Saul was dead and when he was in Hebron in Judah. Okay, so he's got wives, but he doesn't have any children. And yet he is suffering, as are every one of these other soldiers who have lost their families and all of their possessions to the Amalekite raids. So what's the outgrowth of this now? Verse 6, and David was greatly distressed, for the people spake of stoning him. Now this is his army. These are his chosen men. These are the veterans now of all of these years. And yet, to lose everything of value, wiped out. The people spake of stoning him because the souls of all the people was grieved. Every man for his sons and for his daughters. Natural human response. And what is the typical response of human beings when they suffer a loss? They look for someone to blame. And maybe you can argue legitimately that David was to blame. Wasn't he the one who led them into all of this? What if David had never taken them into Philistine territory to begin with? Remember, they had been in there for almost a year and a half. Total time was a year and 4 months, and this is virtually at the end of that year and 4 months, all right, where they have been living in Philistine territory in the city of Ziklag. So maybe all guilt falls at the very feet of David. I think there's a good argument for that. But that's how his men were all viewing it. They wanted somebody to blame for their incredible loss. So human nature always asks, what have you done for me lately? That's kind of the way it goes. Human beings will ride the wave, and they want the good things that come with hitching their wagon to somebody who provides an opportunity for their enrichment. But boy, if that ever turns south, watch and see how many people will jump ship, let alone turn and accuse when things don't go exactly the way they want it to happen. So all these natural events were taking place in the minds of these men. What was David's response, however? Because at any critical time, and you and I face them, out of the blue, a negative circumstance happens that upends everything. And now we have a choice. How will we respond? Many give in to despair. Or if they turn aggressively with some sort of an action, it's going to be according to their own scheme, plan, whatever, to try and fix their situation. That's just how human beings are wired. The question is, who will you trust in difficult times? When you are faced with something unexpected out of the blue that upends everything, and now you're scrambling, as Mr. Raymond Cole would say, to get your feet down mentally, where will you find your anchor? How will you process and deal with the reality of a great trial or a loss? How will you respond to that and move forward? We will either do it the way people in the world do. We'll take things into our own hands according to our own mental faculties. Or else we can respond in a different way. This is what happened. The end of verse 6. Again, every man, the people spake of stoning him, David, because the soul of all the people was grieved, every man for his sons and for his daughters. But David encouraged himself in the Eternal, his God. What did David do? How did David respond? Very differently than all his men did. David was just as grieved as any of them. He suffered the distress, as we already read. But now he dealt with it instead by turning to God and seeking God's help and intervention. That is a huge character point which made David stand out among every other human being of his day. It is very likely that up until this point, David has been working according to his own schemes in the last year and a half without really seeking God. And is this a turning point for him in the storyline? I would argue that it is. I want you to go back with me temporarily to 1 Samuel chapter 27, verses 1 and 2. A quick history of how David got to the decision to go and make this alliance with the Philistines. 1 Samuel 27, verse 1 says, "And David said in his heart," I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than that I should speedily escape into the land of the Philistines. He had been wandering now under the gun as a rebel, hunted by Saul for years. We went through this dispute or debate on how long it was. Was it 6 years? Was it 8 years? However long he's been running, he was tired of it. Very close to death on several occasions. And he got out of the net one more time at the last event. But now he's like, something's got to change. I can't keep doing this. Because Saul is going to get me. One of these days, Saul is going to find me and he's going to win. We need to change the storyline. And so this is what gave him this idea, this scheme, this strategy to move into the Philistine territory with an alliance with the king of Gath. And my question to you is, where was God? Where was God? Did you see David at this time in chapter 27 appeal for God's opinion and his help to know if this is what he should do? Because later in the story, we're going to find out that's exactly what David does. And remember, he's got the high priest Abiathar with him. Abiathar is part of his retinue, his entourage. Did he ask Abiathar to intercede with God and ask God what he should do? No. It tells us right at the beginning of chapter 27, verse 1, David said in his heart, this is the way he felt carnally. This was his knee-jerk reaction to come up with a scheme to make it all work out. He didn't ask God. He did what seemed right. And it was a good scheme, by the way, because, boy, he's gotten everything he wanted. And for a year and a half, virtually, he's had the good graces of the king of Gath, protecting him from Saul. He's not having to run from Saul from anymore. He's in the Philistine protection. And he's doing all his raiding parties into the south, including these very same Amalekites, very likely, are the ones now that are raiding him in return. So far, it's gone really well. Except there's no indication it's what God wanted him to do. This was his own plan. Is this a turning point now where God is actually bringing David back to say, hey, you need to ask me? So God is the one who allowed it. He could have protected David, the soldiers of Israel, and all of their families in Ziklag, couldn't he? So God didn't protect him. God let them all be hauled off as captives. And now David's having to face the reality of that. Instead of justifying himself, David encouraged himself in the Lord his God. It's almost like a turning point now where David says, I got to change the way I'm thinking about it because I'm now getting the fruit of trying to solve my problems my way. And the results are terrible. So finally now, what does he do? Back to 1 Samuel 30 and verse 7. David said to Abiathar the priest, oh, he finally brings in the high priest. What an idea. David said to Abiathar the priest, Ahimelech's son, I pray thee, bring me hither the ephod. And remember, we went through this. That's the ceremonial outer, I'm going to call it a dress. It's not a dress. It's the covering that goes over the high priest's clothing when he actually officiated in God's name on behalf of the people in the service of the tabernacle. And remember, this ephod, this ornate outer garment, also included a place to actually hold those two, whether they're precious stones or whatever they were, called the Urim and the Thummim. Remember, which we said was used as a means for God to answer questions, yes or no questions, without speaking outwardly, like God did do in many past times, including talking directly face to face with Moses and whatnot, but mostly he didn't do that. But through now the use of this question and answer, which you could get a yes or a no answer from God with the Urim and the Thummim, God would literally intervene and answer. And so this is now what David is asking the high priest to help him find out what God wants him to do. What do we do now? David said to Abiathar the priest, Ahimelech's son, I pray thee, bring me hither the ephod. And Abiathar brought hither the ephod to David. And David inquired of the Eternal, saying, shall I pursue after this troop? Shall I overtake them? He's asking God, he's not presuming. Well, of course, if he kept going with the way he'd been acting in the last year and a half, well, yeah, we're going to all go after the Amalekites and get our families and our stuff back. He didn't do that. He finally stopped and he says, I'm not going to presume anything anymore. I'm going to stop and ask what God wants me to do. So he wants to chase, but he's going to ask God first. Shall I pursue after this troop, meaning of the Amalekites? Shall I overtake them? And he, meaning God, answered him, pursue. So God did, through the high priest, give David the answer to his question. And he said, yeah, go after them. Pursue them. For, furthermore, now how this came, I don't know, because you can't get a prophecy and a yes and a no. Some means God inspired through the high priest to enunciate to David this prophecy. He answered him, pursue, for thou shalt surely overtake them and without fail recover all. He not only got God's blessing to chase after the Amalekites, but God even told him prophetically how it was going to come out. Not only did God tell him you were going to be successful in recovering everything, or you're going to find them and you're going to win, you're going to get everything back. You're not going to lose a single thing. That is communication from God. However it happened, that's what occurred. So that obviously then gave David inspiration to go forward. All right, verse 9, David is going to start this chase. So David went, he and the 600 men that were with him, and came to the brook Bezor, where those that were left behind stayed. Who are these left behind? We're getting ready to find out. But he starts with 600 men, and these are basically his key 600 that have been with him. But understand, these men have already been on the road. They are weary. They are exhausted. Because they already went from Ziklag with this meeting with the Philistines in the north, several days travel, were turned away and had to go all the way back home. They were dog tired by the time they got home to Ziklag and wanted nothing more than to find a bed, and instead found their city burned and all of their families taken captive. So instead of resting after already being virtually at the end of their physical endurance, they are off on another trek. And to this point, where is this Brook Bezor? The scholars believe it was identified with what is called today Nahal Bezor, a significant seasonal stream system in the region of southern Israel today. It flows westward across the coastal plain and empties into the Mediterranean Sea south of Gaza, if you want to look all of that up on the map. It probably lies roughly 12 miles south of Ziklag. The scholars don't even know for certain where the city of Ziklag was. They only estimate it. So we're taking a lot of estimations upon estimations. But this whole region, the seasonal stream of Bezor is probably a natural border between the Philistine territory and the desert areas that were dominated by the Amalekites and these other nomadic peoples. All right, so you're probably right at the border. All right. So it served as a natural boundary or a waypoint on the route into the more arid desert territory. So the Amalekites took all this booty, and now they're fleeing back to their territory in the desert. So David and his army are chasing them. To get to this point, they've already gone another 12 miles or so. Let's just assume that. By that point now, verse 10, David pursued, he and 400 men for or because 200 abode behind, which were so faint that they could not go over the brook Bezor. One third of his army was so weak, they literally could not continue to march. And so they stayed and camped right there at that stream. If these 600 men were such elite soldiers, you might ask, why would one third of them be too weak to go on? Well, if you're talking already at the breaking point of well-trained, seasoned soldiers, I would turn it around and say that it's probably more accurate to say it's amazing that two-thirds of his army, 400, could still go on beyond this point. And obviously they were motivated. They had everything at stake with their families. But literally 200 of them were too weak to go on and had no choice but to stop. So David went on with 400 of his strongest soldiers into the desert. Verse 11, another event happens here, which has got to be a divine miracle from God. Verse 11, they found an Egyptian in the field, meaning as they're trekking and I don't know, how well do you track these Amalekites? Had to be a big band, hundreds, even thousands of them, as we're going to find out later. So it's probably fairly easy to track, but who knows? They found an Egyptian in the field and brought him to David and gave him bread, and he did eat, and they made him drink water. And they gave him a piece of a cake of figs and two clusters of raisins. And when he had eaten, his spirit came again to him, for he had eaten no bread nor drunk any water 3 days and three nights. So here's this lone Egyptian out in the middle of the desert, hadn't eaten or drinking anything in 72 hours. David and his soldiers come upon him and basically saved his life. So what value is he going to be to David? Verse 13, and David said unto him, to whom belongest thou? And whence art thou? Where'd you come from? What are you doing here? And he, the Egyptian, said, I am a young man of Egypt, servant to an Amalekite, and my master left me because 3 days agone I fell sick. He was part of the Amalekite raiding parties as a servant to one of the Amalekites, even though he was not Amalekite himself, he was an Egyptian. Now, was he taken in some other foray and became a slave servant to this Amalekite? Doesn't tell anything about his backstory about how he got there, but that was his position. And so now David comes upon him, and guess what? You've got somebody who was a part of the raiders who can give you intelligence about where they're going, what they did, and where they're headed. I'd call that providential, wouldn't you? Do you think that just happened, or do you think God created this circumstance in order to aid David in finding the Amalekites who had their families? And so here, verse 14, the Egyptian tells his story. We made an invasion upon the south of the Cherethites and upon the coast which belongs to Judah and upon the south of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire. Now, he doesn't say they burned any other city. At least in this account, this young Egyptian lad emphasizes the fact they raided, took, but they went out of their way to burn the city of Ziklag. Do you think maybe it's because they were trying to get back at David personally because of all the raiding he had been doing, killing them and taking all of their possessions in the last year and a half? I think it's highly likely. This was payback. So while David and his men were off supposedly supporting the Philistines in the north, the Amalekites took the opportunity for payback. Okay, who were these people now the Egyptian refers to? The south of the Cherethites upon the coast which belongs to Judah upon the south of Caleb. Well, the Cherethites were likely Philistine-related people. So again, these are people in the south. You've got a lot of people who live on the border between nations. And you've got that in others. If you've studied anything about English history. and the people who lived in the border between the Scots and in Northern England. These people that lived on the border were different. And when you live on the border, this is where a lot of the fighting took place. And one year, you know, the ones from the south were raiding into the north. Another year, the ones from the north are raiding into the south. And the people who live near the border were always in a state of flux and are in danger for being in the heart of all of the attacks that are going on. So I suspect the same thing was probably true by a lot of these people that lived right near the borders between these major powers, the Philistines and the desert areas and the Amalekites. And in the east, then with Israel and Judah in particular, whose lands then bordered the same southern desert area. But anyway, these are all peoples that live, I'm going to call it in the borderlands. So these Cherites, the scholars think, were likely more Philistines. They weren't part of the Philistine nation proper, but they were associated, but they lived in the borderlands. What about this? When it says upon the coast, which belongs to Judah, because I think coast, I think ocean. I think, wait a minute, but the land of Judah wasn't on the Mediterranean Sea. There was no coast that bordered the land that God gave to Judah. Well, this word doesn't mean coastal, like water or like ocean. It means territory. So we're talking about the border of Judah, okay? Because Judah is further east. Next to the Philistines were the ones that had the land that actually abutted to the Mediterranean Sea. Judah was to the east of the Philistines in the south. All right. So now you're talking about these Amalekites had raided not just into the Philistine territory. They had raided further east and north into all these territories inhabited by Judah. And in particular now is marked out the land of Caleb. Well, we've already read about that because remember Nabal was of the house of Caleb. And so you're talking about the very same parts where David and his men for years had been roaming around hiding. He was very familiar with it. So these were all the areas that the Amalekites had attacked and raided and taken off their valuables. But it appears Ziklag, David's city, was the only one that was burned. So there seemed to be a revenge element to this entire excursion. Verse 15, David said to him, after this young Egyptian recites this story and gives him this intelligence, David said to him, "Canst thou bring me down to this company? Can you help me find the current location of this Amalekite horde?" And he, the Egyptian boy, said, "Swear unto me by God that you will neither kill me nor deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will bring you down to this company." But he wants an assurance from David. He says, I'll give you everything you want. I'll be your guide. I'll take you right where they are. Apparently, this young lad knew exactly. He didn't have to know where they were headed. He already knew in advance where they were going, which means David was not going to have to track him. All they're going to have to do is follow this young Egyptian who's going to take him right to wherever the Amalekites had chosen to go. David makes a pact with him. He gives him his word. It doesn't say anything about this young Egyptian lad. I suspect this lad now literally becomes a part of the entourage of David from this time forward. He's not in Egypt, which is his homeland. Who would you rather serve, the Amalekites or the Israelites under David? He probably had a much better gig being a servant attached to David and his family. Just speculation. Verse 16, when he, the Egyptian, had brought him, David, down, behold, they were spread abroad upon all the earth, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil that they had taken out of the land of the Philistines and out of the land of Judah. The Egyptian lad took him right to the camp place of this major Amalekite army. They weren't looking behind him at all. They didn't expect to be chased. Supposedly, David and all his band were far to the north with the Philistines about to engage in this battle with King Saul and the Israelites, which, by the way, was happening virtually at the same time we're speaking at. This is a parallel story. When we get to the next chapter, we're going to see that battle. But timeline, these things were likely happening at the very same time. So the Amalekites weren't expecting David and his army. They thought they were alone. They had raided, they got all the booty that they wanted, and they were heading home back to wherever they were going in the desert. They're lounging around. They don't even have guards. There's no sentries. What's the result? Verse 17, and David smote them from the twilight even unto the evening of the next day. We're talking about from one evening to the next evening, a 24-hour battle. And again, think about the physical condition of David and his soldiers. They're dog tired. And then they engage in a 24-hour battle. That almost seems like superhuman strength. I very much suspect that God indeed gave them fortification supernaturally in order to be able to do this. David smote them from the twilight even unto the evening of the next day, and there escaped not a man of them, save 400 young men which rode upon camels and fled. So the only ones of this Amalekite horde that got away were the ones who jumped on camels and took off into the desert. And so, again, we're going because God did not choose to record how many. How many was this band of Amalekites to begin with, and how many did David and his army kill? We don't have it. But if it's written as if the 400 who got away were the small minority, only 400 got away because they jumped on the camels. Well, how large was the rest of the army? If 400 were just the very few who got away and everybody else was decimated by David. Commentators offer infer a total Amalekite force, likely 1,000 to 3,000 people, including actual fighters as well as non-combatants in their entourage. If the 400 escapees were the smaller number and got away, then it's very likely that you're talking about thousands of Amalekites that were killed by David and his men in that 24-hour period. Verse 18, and David recovered all that the Amalekites had carried away, and David rescued his two wives. So just as God prophesied through Abiathar, he says, yes, pursue them, and by the way, you will be successful, and you will get everything back. You won't lose anything at all. Verse 19, and there was nothing lacking to them, neither small nor great, neither sons nor daughters, neither spoil. So all their possession, all their stuff, not just their families, they got all their stuff back. Neither sons nor daughters, neither spoil, nor anything that they had taken to them. David recovered all. An incredible miracle. So again, back up and try to look at it to say, what might have God's intent be? We don't know because he didn't spell it out. But if I try to fill in the gaps of the storyline, it sure looks like God was trying to get David's attention. Did David have God's favor? Yes, indeed. Did that mean David was making every decision correctly? It appears for a year and a half he was going his own way, following his own sense of wisdom. And then God used this to intervene and to shake him up and to make him start relying on God's guidance instead of his own wisdom and experience. He's almost 30 years old at this particular point. How do I know that? Because the parallel event that's going on right now is the death of Saul on the battlefield. That is happening literally at the very same time of this storyline. Saul is dying on the battlefield, including Jonathan and his other sons, which we'll see in the next installment. And then David, now very quickly by God's direction, as we're going to see in the storyline, is going to end up going back into Judah and being anointed as king over the southern kingdom, portion of the kingdom of Judah. And he began to reign, as we're going to see, when he was 30. So he's virtually 30 years old right now, maybe already 30. And I only say that to point out, he's a seasoned warrior now. He's been doing this since he was, how long ago did he kill Goliath? Maybe when he was 15, 16? All right, so this guy, you're talking about a seasoned warrior for the last 15 years. Do you think he had some experience? Do you think he had some accumulated knowledge? Do you think he had some wisdom? Do you think he had some ability to think for himself? Yeah. But do you think it's possible then that he started to think a little bit too much about his own abilities instead of relying on God? Very likely. So this event, why didn't God, if he was going to create this miracle, David and all his men are going to recover all of their families and their goods, and they're not going to lose a single thing. Then why not just protect their homes and their families in Ziklag to begin with? Because God wanted them to go through this. There was a reason for this horrible experience and them having to deal with the incredible loss and the recovery by God's miracle. It was all for a purpose. Well, I don't know how much it changed the men under David, but it sure changed David. He got the message, and he began to behave differently from that point forward. Verse 20, and David took all the flocks and the herds, which they drave before those other cattle, and said, "This is David's spoil." So they actually, all his men called it David's spoil. And now, we're talking about a distinction between all of the Israelites getting back their personal possessions. So the spoil refers to something above and beyond their own possessions that they got. So they weren't just made whole back to even. They actually took a whole lot of the booty that the Amalekites had amassed in all of their raiding for weeks or months. And they got it all. Because all of the Amalekites were slaughtered except for the 400 who got away on camels. They got the entire treasure trove. So God not only restored David and his 600 men, he gave them this huge windfall on top. Now the question is, what's going to happen to all that wealth? Because that serious mistakes could have been made by David at this point, and that's the rest of the story here. But here, the commentators say the people or David's men shouted or proclaimed that this is, they called it David's spoil. They were giving David credit for this incredible result, not only recovering all of their families and their goods, but now this great abundance of the Amalekites. It was a victory shout recognizing, number one, David's leadership, who is the one who had inquired of God, pursued the enemy, and won the battle for them. And number two, this extra blessing from God, they recovered everything that had been taken from them, plus additional plunder of the Amalekites. So the people are all euphoric. And again, isn't that ironic? These are the same ones who just a few days before wanted to stone him when they lost everything. But their fortunes have turned around. They got everything back. They didn't lose a thing. And now they got this big plunder from the Amalekites. David's such a great guy. Again, I tell you, it is with human beings. It's what have you done for me lately? What have you done for me lately? Because it doesn't matter what your track record or what your history of sacrifice. If you stop delivering, very often human beings will then throw you under the bus. What have you done for me lately? Well, David's back on top. God has blessed him. These Israelites want to keep their wagon hitched to him for the good times. What's the aftermath? The next challenge, verse 21. And David came, So now they retreat the 400 with all of this booty. They retrace their steps now to this campsite on the Bezor stream. David came to the 200 men which were so faint that they could not follow David, whom they had made also to abide at the brook Bezor. And they, so these 200 men come out. Here are their comrades and their general returning. And they went forth to meet David and to meet the people that were with him. And when David came near to the people, he saluted them. He greeted them. He showed favor to these 200 that stayed behind. Why is that important? They didn't know how David was going to react to them. After all, they didn't follow forward with the army. What's the natural reaction with ones who stayed behind and weren't strong enough, able enough, or willing enough in order to go forward and fight? They didn't know how David was going to respond until they came to him. He saluted them. He showed them respect and honor at their meeting. How did that contrast to the rest? Well, verse 22, what about the rest of David's men? And we don't know how many of David's men, but here verse 22, then answered all the wicked men and men of Belial, or Belial, of those that went with David, of the 400 now soldiers. God is the one who is writing this account and calls some of these, and who were these? We're not talking about outsiders, foreigner, non-Israelites. We're talking about part of the 400 band of David's chosen men. And yet God is calling them wicked men and men of Belial. Why? Because of their behavior. And said, what did these wicked men say? Because they, the 200 that stayed back that were too weak, the weaklings, and they couldn't go forward and fight with us, because they went not with us, we will not give them aught of the spoil that we have recovered, save or except to every man his wife and his children, that they may lead them away and depart. They're treating these 200 as if they were traitors or cowards. So their idea of fairness, because they said, we're the ones who went and fought. We fought a 24-hour battle against these Amalekites. It's through our hard work that we recovered all of these possessions and this booty from the Amalekites. You 200 that stayed back because you were too weak, yeah, you're going to get your wives and your children back, but that's it. You don't deserve anything else. We're the ones who did the hard work. We're the ones who should get the reward. Good human thinking. Can you see yourself in that position? If not, I challenge you to look again. Have you had circumstances in your life where you felt like you were the one who did the heavy lifting, who put yourself out, and yet you're expected to share something with somebody else? Maybe they didn't deserve it at all. Maybe they didn't have any part of it whatsoever. But in this case, these 200 were part of the band. They were part of the army of David. They had paid their dues over years in many cases. They probably had their own, stories and accomplishments. But in this case, it was too much for them to continue on. Should they really just be cast aside? Should they be treated as traitors or cowards? That's what at least some portion of the 400 wanted to do. David called them wicked and men of Belial because of the way they were behaving and thinking. Now David is faced with a huge challenge. He didn't expect this. He's led them in to a great battle success. They've recovered all the goods. He's probably let down in mind. He just now wants to get home where they can finally rest. They make their way back to the stream at Bezor. putting back the entire army together with the 200, and now he's faced with a challenge. What's David going to do? Verse 23, then said David, "You shall not do so, my brethren. We are not going to treat these 200 comrades that way. You shall not do so, my brethren, with that which the Eternal hath given us." What is David's immediate orientation of mind? He's not thinking physically, carnally, if you will, about who should have and who doesn't deserve, because David is saying, "I don't deserve it. I didn't deserve any of this. This was all a blessing from God, and not a single one of us, even including the 400 who fought courageously, none of us would have had this wealth, let alone the recovery of our families, if it had not been for the divine intervention of God. So who are we to now get stingy? And now we're going to decide which ones of us deserve a reward and which ones don't." It's another one of those traits that David manifested in times of crisis, under pressure, in the moment, where he behaved differently. All a part of this overall theme that I've wanted to emphasize by even covering the books of 1 and 2 Samuel. The reason that God said he was a man after his own heart. And it's not the times when we sit back and calculate and make decisions. It's especially the times under pressure when we act and we demonstrate how we're really wired, what we care about. Then said David, "You shall not do so, my brethren, with that which the Eternal hath given us, who hath preserved us and delivered the company that came against us into our hand." Verse 24, "For who will hearken unto you in this matter?" Meaning to these, whatever portion of the 400 who are now being greedy and stingy, and they're basically wanting to get back at the 200 who didn't actually fight with them. They want to make them suffer. They want to make them pay. They want to divide the army and to make them feel better about themselves and their role and their importance. And David is saying, we are not going to do that. And in verse 24, he says, "Who will hearken unto you in this matter?" Who do you think he says is going to side with you? Who are you looking to agree with you in this philosophy? To sell out your brothers who have fought with you for so many years. Who do you think is going to agree that this is the right way for us to now divide up all of the results? But as his part is that goeth down to the battle, so shall his part be that tarrieth by the stuff. They shall part alike. David makes the edict, and he says, the share that the frontline soldiers get who are in the thick of the battle will be exactly the same as the rear guard who took care of all our belongings at the stream. We will not make a difference in how we divvy up. We will not value one above the other, because everyone is important. Every role is critical to the overall success of this army. There, my dear friends, is a wise general. What would have been the result if he had listened to these others? They were going to send those 200 off with their families and nothing except their families as a punishment, as if they did something wrong. They got too weak to be able to carry on, which is why they had to stop. They were beyond their physical limit. You're really going to punish them for that? David would have lost one third of his army, and he would have set division in the ones that remain with this idea of competition and who individualistic, who can get my share, who is worth more. Well, in the last battle I killed more people than you did, so I deserve a bigger share. Is that really what you want an army to get into? By David's wise adjudication, he assured the unity of the entire body, and he set the standard for the way that these soldiers think about their role in a team effort in that configuration. Everyone in David's band got their own property back, plus an equal portion of the plunder, regardless of whether they went with the 400 or stayed back with the 200. It showed fairness, prevented division, and rewarded faithfulness even among those who were too weak to fight at that particular time. David's wise handling turned potential conflict into unity and an example of generosity. Basically, David showed respect to God as the one who had provided the blessing for all of them. He wasn't going to let any single human being take credit as if they got that by their own efforts because they were more valiant in battle. No, he's saying God is the one who gave this to us as a gift, which means everyone is going to share in their reward. I'm not talking about communism.
You say, well, this sounds like communism.
No. That's a whole different topic. Verse 25, it was so from that day forward. This wasn't a one-time thing. This event and David's action to make a ruling then literally became a statute, if you want to say, in the way he would administer his government for the rest of his life. It was so from that day forward that he made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel unto this day. That this is the way any proceeds from battle with the enemies of Israel would be handled. It boosted morale, it prevented mutiny, and became a standard practice within Israel. It recognized that the support roles, not just the front line, but the team members who are in support roles matter, not just the front line warriors. Verse 26, and when David came to Ziklag, they finally made it back home to their burned city. He sent of the spoil unto the elders of Judah. So now, wait a minute. He divided the spoils with all of his 600 men. Well, David gets a share too. And as a commander, he probably got a double portion himself, which was only right. So probably what you're talking about now is what David did with his share that he controlled. Not reappointing the parts that went to all of his 600 men and their families. When David came to Ziklag, he sent of the spoil unto the elders of Judah, even to his friends, saying, behold, at present, a present for you of the spoil of the enemies of the Eternal. Here David is showing he is incredibly shrewd, he is wise, he is a politician. Yes, you can just say, well, he was doing what was right, because remember, these people of Judah were ones who had also been raided by these Amalekites, which means some portion of the booty that they took from the Amalekites had been originally taken from these families in Judah. So really what he was doing, you can say, well, it's only right that David return some portion of property back to other peoples of the Israelites, his people, who had suffered loss by these same Amalekite raiders. Yes. But furthermore, what David was doing was ingratiating himself with all of these families and these clans in Judah. Do you think that was going to play out? Oh, yeah. In fact, it was immediately going to play out. David did not know that even probably by the time he got back to Ziklag in the Philistine territory, that Saul was already dead. We'll see that in the next installment. But Saul was already dead, very likely. And yet David is making a decision now which is going to help him. Is God leading it? You bet. Is God the one putting all the pieces together to achieve an end? The end result is going to be David on the throne of Israel. Do you think God is orchestrating all of the events in order to line up to achieve that end? Yes. But do you think ingratiating himself with the people you're going to rule is an important part of it? Oh, yeah. These were all carnal, you know, human people. They're all selfish. They're all greedy. They're all covetous. Is there a certain amount when you're dealing with carnal people where you have to kind of deal with those elements? Take that into consideration. Are you going to expect everybody to respond in a spiritual way? That would be highly foolish. So is David bribing these leaders and these families in the southern portion of the tribe of Judah in these borderland areas? In a way, yes. Is he also simultaneously doing what's right? Yes. Is he willing to take both? Oh, yes. And that's exactly what he does. So he sends them a present they were not expecting. They got raided. They got overrun by the Amalekites. They were licking their wounds and thinking their losses were their losses. All of a sudden, David says, hey, I'm going to share some of this wealth we recovered from our mutual enemy. Here's your share. Here's your bonus. Verse 27. And now, from verse 27 to 31 is basically a list of the specific, I'm going to call them districts in Judah. So God considered it important to list them all. You and I don't know the difference in what these things mean. But for the historical record, it's important. So I'll read it very quickly. Verse 27, to them which were in Bethel, and to them which were in South Ramoth, to them which were in Jatir, to them which were in Aor, and to them which were in Siphmoth, to them which were in Esthemoah, and to them which were in Rakal, and to them that were in the cities of the Jezmeelites, and to them which were in the cities of the Kenites, to them which were in Hormah, to them which were in Chorashan, and them which were in Atash, and to them which were in Hebron, which is the main city in the south, by the way, and to all the places where David himself and his men were wont to haunt. Meaning, every place where they had run and camped and moved, in essence, haunted for years to keep away from Saul. This was all this region in southern Judah, in the hill country and in the wilderness. And in essence, David had provided protection. Remember, that was one of the things we learned in the early chapters. With all these fighting men, he had actually provided a service of helping protect them. And now he's giving them this bonus out of the booty from the Amalekites. Guess where David is going to rule for the first 7 years of kingship until he's finally able to unite the entire nation of Israel? It's going to be in that very area. His capital is going to be in Hebron. This is a part of ingratiating himself with the people who is going to be his first loyal supporters, to give him a foothold now into becoming the king over the entire nation. Well, it starts among those people, these clans, and these districts in the tribe of Judah, in the southern part in particular. So all of these are family, clans, important supporters, if you will, blocks that ultimately become part of his political support to help him get ensconced now in the early days of his kingship. All right, that brings us to the end of chapter 30. So next time, we're going to get to the final chapter of the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 31, covering the parallel account of what's been going on while David's been fighting the Amalekites, what's been happening with King Saul, and the army of Israel next time.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented the 30th message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, July 25th, 2026.